book, I have to say, is filled with opinions. For example, he describes all right, spelled A-L-R-I-G-H-T, as not a word. And he says that that if you use aggravate to mean annoy, that is a feminine or childish colloquialism. In addition, he describes the phrase quite all right as all quite wrong. He saw that as redundant. At the same time, Fowler says it's a mistake to assume that none can only be singular, such as none of them is versus none of them are. And we'll talk about this. He also categorizes the prescription against split infinitives under fetishes and superstitions, mocking those who follow the prescription doggedly. So what would Fowler have thought of Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts changing the oath of office when he swore in President Obama in 2008? Let's listen.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear
that I will execute the office of President to the United States faithfully.
That I will execute
the faithfully the office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States faithfully.
Oh dear, what a mess. What's happened here is that Chief Justice Roberts has tried to move the faithfully to the end of the sentence. In the actual oath, faithfully comes between will and execute. I will faithfully execute. It's not a split infinitive, but it's a split verb. And people who feel strongly about split infinitives often feel strongly about split verbs as well. Robert's version moved faithfully to the end. It became solemnly swear that I will execute the office of the President of the United States faithfully. Now, clearly, this is not a question of clarity. It's completely clear what we mean wherever the word faithfully comes. In the end, they redid the oath, and all was fine. What's interesting to me is the way in which this example shows the power of these rules to shape our sense of what is good and appropriate, to the point where we might even change the language in a context that formal and solemn. Now, there is a good reason to know these kinds of rules about things like split infinitives and to fully understand them, as well as to have enough information to make informed decisions about when we want to follow them and when we don't. And that's exactly the aim of this course. One key part of this knowledge is being able to put side by side prescriptive rules about usage and information about actual usage. In the next lecture, we'll turn to the rules that describe actual usage, often called descriptive grammar, so that we can decide whether to believe that two negatives really do cancel each other out in English.
Lecture 3. Descriptivism. How grammar really works.
This lecture could be subtitled, All the Intricate Things You Know That You Don't Usually Give Yourself Credit for Knowing When You Know English Grammar. Let's start by thinking about contractions in English, not in terms of whether or not we should use contractions in formal writing, we'll talk about that in the next lecture, but in terms of where contractions can and cannot happen. We'll start with a straightforward and very common contraction, did plus not. As in, I didn't swim. Now let's coordinate that sentence to see what happens. He swam, but I didn't swim. Okay, straightforward enough. Let's see what happens if we take off the end of that sentence. He swam, but I didn't. Seems completely fine, and it is fine. So in that coordinated sentence, you can omit the main verb, swim, and leave didn't stranded at the end of the sentence. This, I have to say, does not seem like an extraordinary fact at all. But it's not always possible in English to remove the end of the sentence, that main verb, and keep a contraction stranded there at the end of the sentence. Let me show you what I mean. Let's look at another common contraction, I plus am, as in I'm. Here's the sentence, I'm driving. Now let's coordinate that. Let's imagine that we were talking about carpools, and I said, she's driving, and I'm driving. Again, completely straightforward. Let's now try to omit the second verb. She's driving, and I'm. Clearly, we can't do that. You're probably sitting there saying, wait, she's not finished yet. She can't just end with I'm. With that, we cannot omit the main verb at the end of that clause and leave I'm stranded at the end of the sentence. We couldn't strand other pronouns contracted with auxiliary verbs to end a sentence or clause. Let's try this one. Who has traveled to South Africa? She has. Okay, there we omitted the verb, that was fine, but we did not contract the pronoun with the auxiliary verb. Let's try contracting it. Who has traveled to South Africa? She's. Again, you're saying that can't work, because if I just say she's, it feels like I'm not finished with that sentence. This holds true also in comparative sentences, that we can't strand those contractions out there with a pronoun and an auxiliary or a pronoun and to be. Let me show you one where to be is the main verb, not an auxiliary verb or helping verb. And again, what we know is that you can't leave I'm stranded at the end of the sentence. Here's a version of the sentence without a contraction. She's taller than I am. Okay, completely fine. Now let's try contracting it. She's taller than I'm. Nope, can't do it. Now, there are detailed explanations in linguistics for exactly why it is that we can't leave those contractions stranded at the end of a clause or sentence, but we can leave didn't there at the end. I'm not going to get into those explanations here. My point is simply that you know this. You know when you can and can't end a clause with a contraction. Now, no one has ever taught you that. This is intuitive grammatical knowledge learned when you were a child. You just have a gut sense that she's taller than I'm is ungrammatical. And it's ungrammatical in a more fundamental way than a split infinitive is ungrammatical. And really, this is the difference between ungrammatical in the descriptive sense, as we'll be talking about in this lecture, and dispreferred. And the split infinitive is just dispreferred in some contexts. Your knowledge that she's taller than I'm is ungrammatical is fundamental to your linguistic competence as a speaker of English. As a linguist, I'm interested in the complex set of rules that allow us as speakers of English to make grammatical utterances. What I'm going to call this is our descriptive grammar. It describes our competence as speakers that allows us to string words together into utterances that make sense to other people. So what do we know when we know a language like English? Well, we know a lot, and we know a lot at different levels of the structure of the language. For example, we have a lot of knowledge about the sounds of the language. We know which sounds to pay attention to and which sounds are not distinctive in our language. Then, of course, we have an enormous competence around words. We know the vocabulary at our disposal. We also know how those words inflect. How do verbs make past tense? How do nouns make plural? Then there's all our competence around syntax. How can we string words together into clauses and sentences? Put on top of that, all our knowledge about the discourse conventions, which allows us to be competent speakers in everyday conversation. We know how to take turns. We know how to phrase things in more polite ways and less polite ways. This is all part of our competence as speakers. And then, in a highly standardized language like English, our competence may also include all the prescriptive rules that we know, the rules that we know that allow us to write or speak in more formal contexts and then to speak in less formal contexts. When I use grammatical in this lecture, I'm often going to be using it in the descriptive sense. And when I use it in this sense, here's what I mean. I mean that an utterance, if it's grammatical, is rule governed. It obeys the rules in a language that string together words in a way that will be meaningful to other speakers, that the words are inflected in ways that will be meaningful to other speakers. In other words, that the sentence or utterance is systematically constructed according to the system of the language for the order of the words, the agreement of nouns and verbs, that kind of thing. And when you have grammatical utterances that are systematically constructed, they can then be parsed by other speakers or readers if you're writing. In this sense, in the descriptive sense, a rule is actually an established pattern of usage that speakers recognize. When linguists write descriptive grammars trying to capture all of this knowledge, these grammars are huge. It's fascinating to compare those with style guides like Strunk and White, which are so slim by comparison. And there's a reason for that. Style guides capture only a small percentage of the usage issues in a language. Style guides go after those usage issues where there's variation, where perhaps there's a change in progress, and they try to tell us what is more and less proper usage. A descriptive grammar needs to capture the whole language, both where there's variation and where we all agree on the rules of a language. In this course, we'll spend a lot of time on the prescriptive rules that we feel we're supposed to know. And we'll also compare those with the rules, the patterns of actual usage. The most remarkable feature of the grammar of human languages is that we can create an infinite number of utterances from a finite set of resources. This was captured eloquently by Wilhelm von Humboldt, who was a German philosopher in the late 18th and 19th century, and a linguist. He was also the brother of the famous naturalist and explorer Alexander von Humboldt. And what he said was, and here I quote, "Language makes infinite use of finite means." Interestingly, at one point I was telling students this in a course at the University of Michigan, and I said, language, we can create an infinite number of utterances from a finite set of resources. And a student raised his hand and he said, "Well, surely you do not mean infinite in the mathematical sense." And I thought, how else could I mean infinite? And I do mean infinite in the mathematical sense. I mean infinite. There is no limit. And this gets to human creativity. Yes, we make new words, and that's one of the wonderful parts of human creativity with language. But here I'm talking about creativity with syntax, with grammar. I'm talking about how we can take the words we have and combine them in an infinite number of ways. This is what von Humboldt was getting at. Think about what you're doing right now as you listen to me. You're listening to sentences you've never heard before. I've never uttered these sentences in exactly this way before. And yet, I hope you're understanding me clearly, even though this sentence is entirely new for you. The way this works is that you and I agree on the conventions of language. We agree on what each linguistic sign means. In other words, if we take a sign like the word skunk, well, you and I all agree that that refers to a little critter that is black and white and can make a huge stink. Now, if I suddenly started using skunk to mean pillow, you and I would have a problem because now we wouldn't be able to communicate. But that's not the way human language works. There's a convention behind the signs. And then there's convention with grammatical rules or patterns. You expect me to have my subjects in particular places, my verbs in particular places, my determiners before the nouns. And when I do that, I can combine those nouns and verbs and in creative ways because they're in the right place for you, which allows you to parse the utterance. Now, how do we know that we can create an infinite number of utterances? Well, the answer is what linguists would call recursion. Recursion is the ability to embed an infinite number of elements into a grammatical structure. And once you can do this, there are no limits on how long or how new a sentence can be. An example is going to help here. Watch the way I'm going to embed clause inside clause in this sentence. Here comes the sentence. My sister explained that my nephew said that his sister whispered to him that her friend had told her that her brother said, that her mother said, that her father said, and I could keep putting in noun plus said forever. And each time I do that, the sentence is going to mean something new. He said, that she said, that we said, that I said. Each time, it means a new thing. And that's how we can say that the language is infinitely creative, because I can keep making new sentences that way. Now, of course, your brain can't actually process that sentence once I've embedded probably more than four of those clauses inside each other. Your brain says, I give up. I can't figure out what this sentence means, but I could keep going. Now, there is a current debate in the field about whether all human languages have recursion, but it has been a standing assumption that all languages, human languages, do. From this definition of grammar and grammatical, that is, that a language follows the rules or patterns of that language in order to communicate meaning, let's talk about what ungrammatical means. It would mean that a sentence does not follow the patterns of a variety of English. Now, we already talked about the sentence, she's taller than I'm, and I think we can all agree that that feels ungrammatical. Now, here's another example with word order. We know that the following sentence is just fine. A dog chased me down the street. Not that exciting, clearly grammatically fine. We know that this sentence is not fine. Dog-a chased me down the street the. You're probably having a little trouble following that. And that's because it's ungrammatical. I said dog-a and street the. But we know that determiners need to come before nouns. It needs to be a dog and the street. Here's another ungrammatical version. A dog chased me the street down. Nope. Because we know that prepositions need to come before the noun phrase. It should be down the street, not the street down. Let me just give you one more example. Dog me street down chased a the. Okay, so that's a total mess. It doesn't even follow subject, verb, object, word order. Those we can all agree are ungrammatical. What about the sentence, we don't have nothing to hide? Is that grammatical in the descriptive sense? To answer that question, let's start by thinking historically. Of course, what we're talking about here is double negation. And double negation is now considered non-standard. And I'll sometimes hear it described as illogical or wrong, which is, of course, different from being non-standard. And I would argue that calling double negation illogical or wrong is not fair. Being non-standard does not make something wrong or illogical, or at least any more illogical than some of the things we consider standard. I want to talk about this here because the history of double negation shows us that the standard can change over time. And this is a really useful perspective to have as we think about descriptive and prescriptive grammar. All right, so double, or sometimes we call it multiple negation because you can have more than two, this occurs when we have more than one negative marker on the clause. So that could be not plus nothing, not plus no one, not plus never, not plus no. Now, of course, many languages in the world do this. We'll just take French as one example. If you want to say, I don't know in French, you would say, je ne sais pas, where the ne, je ne, is a negative, and the pas is also a negative. So French does double negation, completely standard. Standard American English now employs single negation. So we would say, in standard varieties of English, we don't have anything to hide. But there is a long history of multiple negation in English. Let me give you a few examples from hundreds of years ago. The first one comes from a document called the Peterborough Chronicle, which was recording the history of Britain. This entry is from 1137, and it's describing the consequences of the civil war under King Stephen. And here is the sentence. This would be early Middle English. The Ertha Nebar Nancorn. Okay, if we were to translate that directly into modern English, it would be something like, the earth not bore no corn. So you'll see the double negation, not and no. In standard English now, we'd say, the earth didn't bear any corn. Here's Chaucer with some double negation. This is from the description of the knight in the general prologue of the Canterbury Tales. He never yet no villainy ne said. Okay, so there we have never. We also have no and ne. So we, in fact, have triple negation. If we were to translate it directly, it would be something like, he never no evil thing not said. Or to translate it into modern standard English, he never ever said anything vile or evil. Those three negatives in there, we probably should read as just emphatic. Let me give you one more historical example of double negation, this one from Shakespeare. This is from As You Like It, and we have Celia asserts, I cannot go no further. A nice double negation. The system for making English, for making negation in earlier forms of English was just different from the way it is now. So you could have double or multiple negation. You had the n, n-e, rather than not, and it was inserted right before the verb. So ne bar, with the corn example, or ne said, didn't say. We now use not, and it is inserted after an auxiliary verb. So cannot, has not, did not say. Standard varieties of English no longer use double negation, but it's important to note that many varieties of English continue to use double negation, and this is carrying on a long tradition in the language. Now, there is a myth out there that two negatives cancel each other out. And I have to say, that is clearly not true in these cases. If we think about something like, we don't have nothing to hide, it is clear to all of us that that does not mean we have something to hide. Those negatives do not cancel each other out. I will hear people say, but in math, if you multiply two negatives, you get a positive. Okay, that is true, but I have two responses to that. One is, language is not math. The second is, okay, fine, let's do math. If you have two negatives in math and you add them, what do you get? You actually get a bigger negative. Now, it is true that there are some double negatives in modern English where the negatives do cancel each other out, or at least kind of cancel each other out. If you think about the phrase, not unhappy, well, clearly the not and the un are contradicting each other and counteracting each other, but I would also argue that not unhappy is not the same thing as happy. If I'm not unhappy, I'm just not unhappy. It does not mean I'm all the way to happy. I also want to note here that there is a way that we can use intonation on a double negative to make those two negatives cancel each other out. For example, we don't have none, which would mean, okay, so we have some. But if I were to say it differently, we don't have none. That means we don't have any. So, to answer my question of is double negation grammatical, we must consider double negation grammatical for many varieties of English. It is not formal, it is not standard, but it's completely systematic, and it's well understood by speakers of all varieties. When Pink Floyd says, we don't need no education, we all know exactly what they mean. This is a good moment to make a key point about how English grammar works. And that is that there isn't just one English grammar. All varieties of English spoken in speech communities have systematic grammars, and they don't all stem from standard English, I think it can be tempting because Standard English is such a prominent presence to think that all the other varieties come derived from that, but that's not actually true. The standard was just elevated for social and political reasons. We need to talk about English grammars in the plural, as there are many varieties of English. Standard American English is just one of them. Standard English will be the focus of much of this course, but I will often point out differences in other varieties and talk about how the standard variety has changed over time. Now let's return to negation, and we'll take the kind with just one negative, the kind in Standard American English. If we step back from a negative sentence to examine what is at work, or what's at play here, it can give you a taste of just how much you know when you know English grammar. Let's take a very simple, straightforward sentence. It did not rain. What do you need to know to construct that sentence in terms of the negation? Well, you need to know that the not goes after the auxiliary verb. It did not rain. You would not say, it not did rain, or not it did rain. Then we know that we could contract it. It didn't rain. And of course, the auxiliary verb comes before the main verb. We say, it didn't rain, not, it rained didn't. I know that I'm saying things that are so completely obvious to you, but in fact, you did have to learn these when you were a kid. Now, what happens if there's more than one auxiliary verb in the sentence? Take, for example, the cake has been eaten. We have two auxiliaries, has and been. Well, what you know is that the not goes in after the first auxiliary. The cake has not been eaten. You would not say, the cake has been not eaten. Or if you did, that would be for a particular rhetorical purpose. It wouldn't be just a generic negation. And again, you would know when you could contract. You know you can say, the cake hasn't been eaten. That's a lot of knowledge about how to insert not to make a negative sentence that you probably have never had to spell out that way before. You just learned it when you were a kid. And interestingly, you went through stages learning it. Kids often say things like, no wear shoes, before they get the rule that you need an auxiliary verb plus not. What are other examples of descriptive rules of the language? Well, we've already covered some. Determiners come before nouns. And there is an order to those determiners, which we'll be talking about. You would say, all her many friends, not her all many friends. We know that adjectives will come between the determiner and the noun. So we would say something like a silly song, where silly comes between a and song. Another descriptive rule, well, to make most nouns plural, add s, silly songs. And once we've made it plural, we know that we can't use a. You can't say a silly songs, but you could say the silly songs. We also talked about how prepositions precede the noun phrase. We would say, in my head. And if we want to talk about the silly songs in my head, we would say, silly songs in my head, not silly in my head songs. I know that these rules seem very basic and not worth spending time on, but it's powerful stuff to remember how much we know when we know English grammar. The usage rules that we worry about, is it less or fewer here? Can I split that infinitive? Are just a fraction of the universe of English grammar. What I'll show you is that being able to compare how the language works descriptively with the rules we're told to follow in formal speech and writing can help you make even more informed decisions about usage. And you'll gain a new perspective on some of the rules you may have learned in school or elsewhere. What do I mean by this new perspective? Well, let's return to double negation. We've discussed that historically, double negation has been rule-governed and continues to be rule-governed or grammatical in many varieties of English and, of course, in many other languages. But in the 18th century, Bishop Louth, in his very influential grammar, introduced the idea that negatives could cancel each other out. Now, the example he gave from Paradise Lost is an example where the negatives do counteract each other. The sentence was, nor did they not perceive the evil plight in which they were. And there you can see the nor and the not are counteracting, at least to some extent. The issue is that that piece of advice or that statement he made about how those two negatives cancel each other out to make a positive got extended in later guides, and it got extended to sentences like, we don't have nothing to hide. And then those sentences were declared illogical as if those negatives canceled each other out. We now avoid double negatives in standard American English, and it's not a prestige form. And what I'm struck by is that it is, as I've said, so often condemned as wrong or bad English. But what I hope I've shown you is that there's nothing inherently wrong or uneducated about the construction. In fact, it used to be high writing. And would you believe that some people thought that the move to single negation in standard varieties of English wasn't necessarily a good thing? There's a great quote from the London Review published in 1864, and it's republished in FitzEdward Hall's book Modern English in 1873. And this quote laments the loss of double negation as one of the many lamentable changes in the English language. It sets up the King James Bible, published in 1611, as the high point of English usage, and since then, all the changes have been for the worse. And it states, and here I quote, "The double negative has been abandoned to the great injury of strength of expression." You don't hear that complaint anymore, or you don't never hear that in usage guides now. Now, just to be clear, I'm not advocating that we all suddenly start using double negation in formal prose, although there would be absolutely nothing wrong with that, or that we stop teaching students about the issue. It's important to teach students about the standard use, but it's equally important not to condemn the non-standard use, as this isn't well-founded. I want you to just imagine a student who is a speaker of a variety of English that uses double negation coming into a classroom and being told that the two negatives in "we don't have nothing" cancel each other out. That student knows that that's not true. And suddenly, if you've said that, you're the one who loses some credibility, because that just clearly isn't true to the grammar. To recognize these different definitions of grammatical is, to me, what it means to be careful about our grammar, to be sure that what we're saying is accurate and fair about how both prescriptive and descriptive grammar work. What I'm trying to do is separate out the social judgment that we put onto grammar from the grammar itself. It's helpful for us to understand that social judgment and be able to navigate it as speakers and writers. We want to know our audience, and we don't want to distract them or annoy them. It is also intellectually interesting to see how those judgments change over time. I would argue that this perspective and background knowledge actually make us better editors and teachers, because we understand the formal written variety in the context of all the varieties of English out there. And I have to say, as a teacher, I have found it a more engaging and empowering way to think about and to teach grammar. It gives us credit for all that we already know and acknowledges the variation that we know is out there. We know that some people use single negatives, some people use double negatives. And we know that both of those constructions can function really well in context. Part of mastering the game of the formal standards in writing and speech is to understand how these usage rules may ask us to switch up our language from informal to formal context, from speech to writing. My hope is that all of this knowledge, this perspective, can make grammar playful again, as opposed to a world of absolute rights and absolute wrongs. We, as humans, love to play with language. And I don't want people to fear grammar, to have that red pen frightened feeling when they hear the word grammar. It's interesting to think about not just whether one can use double negation in formal writing at this point, most of the time no, unless for specific rhetorical purposes, but I also want to think about why standard English uses single negation when many languages and older varieties of English use double negation. That's worth talking about. That's history. That's diversity. That's really deeply understanding English grammar. With all of this background on different approaches to grammar, it's time to dive into the details of parts of speech. How many parts of speech did you learn there are in English? If you learned that there are 8, I'm going to add a few more. And in this lecture, we've talked a lot about the word not. Where does that fit in terms of parts of speech? What about the word We'll address these questions in the next lecture.
Lecture 4. Rephrasing.
I grew up in the heyday of Schoolhouse Rock. There were 37 of these animated educational shorts produced between 1972 and 1979. And they came with the kids' television programming on ABC. Often, I will admit, as an unwelcome interruption in the Saturday morning cartoons. But, like many in my generation, I can still sing many of the lyrics of I'm Just a Bill. And I will spare you and not sing it, but who can forget the lyrics? Yes, I'm only a bill, and I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Now that's one of the better known ones, along with 3 is a magic number and conjunction junction. Conjunction junction is part of the series Grammar Rock, which aired from 1973 to 1975. And it's really interesting to look back on these shorts now. In Conjunction Junction, they sing about hooking up words and phrases and clauses. Did we even know what that meant as we sang along? This lecture is the last of our background lectures before we dive into the usage rules related to different parts of speech. In this lecture, we'll address how many parts of speech are there, and how do we define them? How accurate, for example, is Grammar Rock's song, a noun is a person, place, or thing? And what is the difference between a phrase and a clause? There's a standard hierarchy when we talk about grammar, which goes from word to phrase to clause to sentence, and we'll proceed in that order in this lecture. The kind of terminology that we're going to review in this lecture is critical for the remaining 20 lectures. Now, I know that for some of you, this will be review, and I would guess and I hope that it will provide some new ways of thinking about familiar concepts in terms of how we define and categorize words into parts of speech or lexical categories. Before I do an overview of the lexical categories in English, or what are often known as parts of speech, let's start by clarifying a key distinction that builds on the material from the previous 2 lectures. And that distinction is between what lexical category a word belongs to versus what lexical category we think a word should belong to. The word that jumps to mind here is impact, which is accepted as a noun. For example, here's a sentence with impact as a noun. The court's decision will have a significant impact on university admissions. It's, however, not always accepted as a verb. It is a verb that means to have an impact on, but a good number of people, including many usage guide writers, think it should not be a verb that means to have an impact on. Now, I want to note here that usage guide writers, of course, wouldn't have an opinion on this if people weren't already saying it. In 2001, which is the last time that the American Heritage Dictionary surveyed the usage panel on impact as a verb, 80% of the panel rejected the following sentence. The court ruling will impact the education of minority students. They described it as somewhat or completely unacceptable. Now, of course, it's not that the members of the usage panel didn't know what that sentence meant. It was just that they didn't like it. It was dispreferred. Brian Garner, in his influential book, Modern American Usage, addresses impact as a verb. And he admits that this use of impact as a verb has become widespread. But he also concludes that it should be avoided because we already have the synonyms effect and influence. Now, I have to say that if we were to rule out words based on the fact that they have synonyms in the language, we'd have to take a whole lot of words out of the English language. And I'm not completely persuaded that impact and effect are exactly synonymous. Garner goes on to say that for him, the impact of using impact as a verb this way is too jarring. Now, of course, we need to remember there that it's jarring to him. It's clearly not jarring to the many people who use it. According to Garner and many others, you should only use impact as a verb if you're talking about impacted teeth. What I want to make clear here is that impact is a verb at this point that means to have an impact on. That cannot be questioned when you look at actual usage. The question, then, is whether we're allowed to use impact as a verb this way in formal writing. You can find lots of examples in formal writing, but many style guide writers still balk. Now, I have to say I'm struck by the advice that we get when we're told to avoid impact as a verb, and we're told we'll use have an impact on. But sometimes these same writers are saying, be sure to be concise, and have an impact on is much wordier than just using impact as a verb. The word impact captures a phenomenon in modern English that is very relevant to a discussion of lexical categories. Words can change categories, or more often, expand into new categories because they keep their former part of speech. For example, nouns get verbed. Think about to Google. Verbs get nouned. Consider a hire. Adjectives get verbed to clean. And sometimes people aren't happy about words changing categories like that. Here, I find it helpful to remember Ben Franklin. And why do I want to remember Ben Franklin? Well, Ben Franklin also didn't like some words that were changing categories, particularly a few nouns that became verbs. He wrote to Noah Webster in 1789 about several new verbs that he had noticed that had been newly created from nouns. They were advocate, notice, and progress. He was writing to Webster in hopes that Webster would also criticize them. We, of course, now look at Franklin's concern about those three verbs as very quaint, because all three verbs are now totally standard. You can, of course, decide which one of these neologisms, or perhaps all of them, you don't want to use, and you can opt out. But I hope that you can see the movement of words across lexical categories as a fascinating aspect of modern English. How can this happen so easily in modern English? Well, part of the answer is that in modern English, we have very few inflectional endings, as we'll talk about. For example, regular verbs just take ed to make past tense. So it's not too hard to take a noun and make it a verb. Google, googled. Nouns just take s to make plural and possessive if they're regular nouns. Again, not that hard to make hire a noun, and then you can have many hires. We don't have grammatical gender in modern English anymore, so when you create a new noun, you don't have to give it a gender. You don't have to decide is it masculine, feminine, or neuter. So you can take a verb like invite and make it a noun. And as I said, doesn't need gender, and now you can make it plural, multiple invites. Now I know that there are a lot of folks who don't like invite as a noun. And I will admit that I am also not a big fan, although I am quite sure that I have used it in informal contexts. I was surprised to learn how old the noun invite is. I had fallen prey to the recency illusion and believing that invite as a noun was quite new. When you look in the Oxford English Dictionary, invite as a noun shows up as early as 1659. People were giving and accepting invites in the 17th century. This grammatical flexibility in modern English that allows words to jump around among lexical categories enhances how creative we can be. We can be playful when we do this. We can be informal. We can also be responsive to new needs. Again, think about to Google. Okay, this seems like a good moment to step back for a quick review of what lexical categories are available in English. And while there is some basic agreement on this, not everyone agrees on the terminology or how many categories there are. Lexical categories, which are, as I've said, what linguists call parts of speech, can be divided into two big categories. And those big categories are open class and closed class. Open class includes nouns, verbs, adjectives, and adverbs. We call this open class because those categories take on new members easily. We can create new nouns, create new verbs, turn a noun into a verb, an adjective into a noun. So we call those open class, accepting new members. Then you have closed class words. This includes pronouns, determiners, auxiliary verbs, conjunctions, some linguists would say coordinators and subordinators instead of conjunctions, and prepositions. We call these closed class because these categories very rarely take on new members. It's not that they never do, but we don't see new pronouns or new prepositions all that often. Now, there are words that defy the lexical categories that I've just named. For example, discourse markers. This gets us to words like Discourse markers are those little words that occur at the edges of conversation that help direct traffic in conversation. Words like well, so. We call them discourse markers, and we'll talk about them in much more detail in Lecture 21. Here, I just want to note that they are probably best considered their own lexical category. You also have interjections like ouch, which we probably want to deal with as their own category. Then, what to do with the word not? Some will call it an adverb because it works within the verb phrase, and that's fine. But some will say it's a pretty unique, or one could say unique, if you don't think that unique should be gradable. It's a unique word, and it should be its own category in and of itself. In the lectures to come, we'll be delving into each of these parts of speech and the various points of usage that surround them. In this lecture, I want to talk about how we define what makes a noun or what makes a preposition or an auxiliary verb. And then we'll talk about phrases and clauses. So, does grammar rocks, song, a noun is a person, place, or thing, hold up? The answer is no. Not entirely. Relying purely on what a word means, or what I would call semantic criteria, to define a part of speech is often difficult and inadequate. If you take nouns, it is true that they are often persons, places, and things. But nouns are also abstract concepts, love, confusion. They're states of being, like limbo. And they are actions, such as running. And with that last one of action, we can now see that we have blurred the line between nouns and verbs if we rely only on semantic criteria. What we end up with is something like, a noun can describe an action when it does it like a noun. You can actually see this blurriness in the Grammar Rock lyrics for the animated short, Verb, That's What's Happening. The song lists to be, to sing, to feel, to live, all as verbs. It's then followed by this lyric. A verb expresses action, being, or state of being. Now, obviously, a noun can also express action, being, or state of being with words like action or state of being. In other words, we've defined a verb with nouns. As a result, linguists will come at defining parts of speech from at least two other angles. First, how a word behaves in terms of the inflectional endings it takes. And second, how a word behaves in terms of how it works in a phrase or clause or sentence. So first, what kinds of inflectional endings does a word take? This is what we would call morphology, and it's about both inflectional endings and derivational endings. Let's start with inflectional endings. Nouns tend to make plural with an S. Cat, cats. Verbs tend to make past tense with ED and present participles with ing. So walk, walked, walking. Adjectives can make comparatives with ER or with more. So happy, happier, beautiful, more beautiful, and so on. These can be good tests to see if something is a noun or a verb or an adjective. Does it behave this way inflectionally? Also, there are some derivational endings that tend to signal what lexical category a word is in. For example, if you see a word ending in I-Z-E, odds are that it's a verb. For example, colonize or problematize, which I know is a verb that many people don't like. If you see a word ending in I-O-N or M-E-N-T, odds are that it's a noun. For example, realization or retirement. So that's one way to think about what lexical category a word is in, is how does it behave in terms of its inflectional endings, or what do its derivational endings signal? The second way to think about it is what slot can the word fill in a phrase or clause? And I have to say, this is a very helpful way to think about and test parts of speech. This gets us into syntax, how words are strung together into phrases and clauses, and we can see how intuitive this is. For example, nouns tend to be able to sit after the. So if we get the blank, you will tend to get a noun. The cat, the love, the running I was doing this morning. Verbs will typically be able to come in the slot after will. Will blank, will swim, will walk, will go. Adjectives come between a determiner like the and a noun. Let's take a pretty generic noun like thing, the blank thing. We can put in adjectives, the happy thing, the ridiculous thing. But we couldn't put an adverb in there. We couldn't say the slowly thing. We could say the slow thing. Slow is the adjective, slowly is the adverb. Auxiliary verbs, the slot they like is between a subject, here let's use the pronoun she, and a main verb like go. She blank go. She will go. She may go. She might go. Those are all auxiliary verbs. Prepositions come right before a noun phrase. Blank the tree. Some prepositions that could fit there. In the tree, up the tree, down the tree, around the tree, to the tree. All prepositions. Now, some of these tests work better than others, and some parts of speech are easier to test for than others. You'll notice that I have not given you a test for adverbs, and I have to say that that is because they are very tricky. There is one morphological signal, one derivational ending, ly, that can signal adverbs, slowly, extremely, frankly. Except, of course, when the ly signals that it's an adjective, lovely, homely. We'll talk in a later lecture about what happened in the history of English that ly can do both. But ly is now not entirely a predictable ending in terms of whether something's an adverb. Syntactically, adverbs can appear all over the sentence, and they modify all kinds of things, verbs, adjectives, other adverbs. So it's hard to have a test where you have one slot and say adverbs fit there. Sometimes adverbs, as a result, are called the trash can category. I hope this brief survey gives you a sense of two other ways to define parts of speech other than semantically. We can look at morphology, what endings the words take, and syntax, where they show up in a phrase or clause or sentence. Now let's turn to the difference between a phrase, a clause, and a sentence. If we return to conjunction junction, we have the wonderful lyric, hooking up words and phrases and clauses. So what is the difference between a phrase and a clause? Simply put, a clause is composed of a subject and a predicate. And a predicate is the verb and all its, let's call them, accoutrements. All the objects it's coming with, maybe some prepositional phrases. Let's take a sentence as an example. My sister took all four kids to the aquarium. That's a clause. The subject is my sister. The predicate is took all four kids to the aquarium. Here's a simpler sentence. I am tired. Subject, I. Predicate, am tired. So those are clauses. A phrase is a group of words that work together within a clause, but is not a clause. To clarify, it can help to think intuitively about the chunks within a clause, or what linguists would call constituents. Let's go back to my example sentence. My sister took all four kids to the aquarium. We know that the all there is more related to the four kids, in all four kids, than it is to took, as in took all. We have an intuition about that. Sentences and clauses work in chunks, and these chunks are then nested within each other. So it's not like train cars, even though that's how conjunction-junction animates the words in a sentence in that wonderful short. Instead, the words, they don't all line up one in a row with equal relationships to each other. Rather, they nest in chunks, and then those nest within bigger structures within the sentence. Linguists often use trees as a way to capture this hierarchy where you have words being related to each other, and then they're drawn up into a larger structure. Let's go back to my sentence about my sister in the aquarium and unpack it in terms of phrases. As I already mentioned, the whole sentence here is one clause with a subject, my sister, and a predicate, took all four kids to the aquarium. My sister is a noun phrase. Those two words function together like a noun. So you have the noun sister at the head and the determiner my. We could substitute in a proper noun like Elizabeth or a pronoun like she. All four kids is also a noun phrase. Those three words together function like a noun. Here it is, the direct object of took. The aquarium is also a noun phrase. And in this case, it's nested inside another kind of phrase, which is a prepositional phrase, to the aquarium. Prepositional phrases are interesting because they can function like adverbs and they can function like adjectives. In this sentence, the prepositional phrase to the aquarium is functioning adverbially. It describes where my sister took all four kids. A very similar prepositional phrase, at the aquarium, in a different sentence, could function like an adjective. Let's imagine the sentence, my niece loved the sharks at the aquarium. There, the prepositional phrase at the aquarium modifies the noun sharks, and sharks at the aquarium, the sharks at the aquarium, is one big noun phrase. So if I were to ask, what did my niece love, we could say, the sharks at the aquarium. What is the difference between a clause and a sentence? Well, as I've already shown you, they can be the same thing when a sentence has only one clause. But a sentence can have more than one clause. Let's imagine, again, my sister, and here's a longer sentence. My sister took all four kids to the aquarium, but it was inexplicably closed. There we've got two clauses connected by but, and we have a compound sentence. When you have sentences that are more than one clause, they can be compound sentences or complex sentences, something we'll come back to in a later lecture. Let's end this lecture with the question of what a sentence is. It seems so easy and so straightforward because we believe in sentences, but there actually isn't a clear or straightforward answer to exactly what a sentence is. I'm fascinated by this because it's such a fixture in discussions of grammar that we can assume that we understand what a sentence is. Here's one definition of a sentence. It's a written string of words that is, and here I'm going to quote one definition, complete in and of itself and ends with a period. How happy are you with that definition? It's a little vague. What does it mean that it's complete in and of itself? The part about it ending with a period is less vague, but makes clear that this is a written item, that the sentence is written. Now, typically, a sentence is one or more clauses. But we can also have fragments that we can